Chapter 16. Is religion child abuse? Tell me straight out, I call on you. Answer me. Imagine that you yourself are building the edifice of human destiny with the object of making people happy in the finale, of giving them peace and rest at last. But for that you must inevitably and unavoidably torture just one tiny creature, that same child who was beating her chest with a little fist, and raise your edifice on the foundation of her unrequited tears. Would you agree to be the architect on such conditions? Tell me the truth. Ivan to Alyosha in The Brothers Karamazov. When we consider whether religion has done more harm than good, not that this would say anything at all about its truth or authenticity, we are faced with an imponderably large question. How can we ever know how many children had their psychological and physical lives irreparably maimed by the compulsory inculcation of faith? This is almost as hard to determine as the number of spiritual and religious dreams and visions that came true, which in order to possess even a minimal claim to value would have to be measured against all the unrecorded and unremembered ones that did not. But we can be sure that religion has always hoped to practice upon the unformed and undefended minds of the young, and has gone to great lengths to make sure of this privilege by making alliances with secular powers in the material world. One of the great instances of moral terrorism in our literature is the sermon preached by Father Arnall in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. This disgusting old priest is readying Stephen Dedalus and his other young charges for a retreat in honour of St. Francis Xavier, the man who brought the Inquisition to Asia, and whose bones are still revered by those who choose to revere bones. He decides to impress them with a long and gloating account of eternal punishment, of the sort which the Church used to mandate when it still had the confidence to do so. It is impossible to quote the entire rant, but two particularly vivid elements concerning the nature of torture and the nature of time are of interest. It is easy to see that the priest's words are designed precisely to frighten children. In the first place, the images are themselves childlike. In the torture section, the very devil himself makes a mountain shrivel like wax. Every frightening malady is summoned, and the childlike worry that this pain might go on forever is deftly played upon. When it comes to the picture of a unit of time, we see a child on the beach playing with grains of sand, and then the infantile magnification of units. Daddy, what if there were a million, million, million squillion kittens? Would they fill up the whole world? And then, adding further multiplicities, the evocation of nature's leaves, and the easily conjured fur and feathers and scales of the family pet. For centuries, grown men have been paid to frighten children in this way, and to torture and beat and violate them as well, as they also did in Joyce's memory and the memory of countless others. The other man-made stupidities and cruelties of the religious are easy to detect as well. The idea of torture is as old as the nastiness of mankind, which is the only species with the imagination to guess what it might feel like when imposed upon another. We cannot blame religion for this impulse, but we can condemn it for institutionalizing and refining the practice. The museums of medieval Europe, from Holland to Tuscany, are crammed with instruments and devices upon which holy men labored devoutly in order to see how long they could keep someone alive while being roasted. It is not needful to go into further details, but there were also religious books of instruction in this art, and guides for the detection of heresy by pain. Those who were not lucky enough to be allowed to take part in the auto da fe, or act of faith, as a torture session was known, were permitted free rein to fantasize as many lurid nightmares as they could, and to inflict them verbally in order to keep the ignorant in a state of permanent fear. In an era where there was little enough by way of public entertainment, a good public burning or disembowelment or breaking on the wheel was often as much recreation as the saintly dared to allow. Nothing proves the man-made character of religion as obviously as the sick mind that designed hell, unless it is the sorely limited mind that has failed to describe heaven, except as a place of either worldly comfort, eternal tedium, or, as Tertullian thought, continual relish in the torture of others. Pre-Christian hells were highly unpleasant too, and called upon the same sadistic ingenuity for their invention. However, some of the early ones we know of, most notably the Hindu, were limited in time. A sinner, for example, might be sentenced to a given number of years in hell, where every day counted as 6,400 human years. If he slew a priest, the sentence thus adjusted would be 149,504,000,000 years. At this point, he was allowed nirvana, which seems to mean annihilation. It was left to Christians to find a hell from which there was no possible appeal, and the idea is easily plagiarized. I once heard Louis Farrakhan, leader of the heretical black-only Nation of Islam, as he drew a hideous roar from a mob in Madison Square Garden. Hurling spittle at the Jews, he yelled, "And don't you forget, when it's God who puts you in the ovens, it's forever." The obsession with children and with rigid control over their upbringing has been part of every system of absolute authority. It may have been a Jesuit who was first actually quoted as saying, "Give me the child until he is 10 and I'll give you the man," but the idea is very much older than the school of Ignatius Loyola. Indoctrination of the young often has the reverse effect, as we also know from the fate of many secular ideologies. But it seems that the religious will run this risk in order to imprint the average boy or girl with enough propaganda. What else can they hope to do? If religious instruction were not allowed until the child had attained the age of reason, we would be living in a quite different world. Faithful parents are divided over this, since they naturally hope to share the wonders and delights of Christmas and other fiestas with their offspring, and can also make good use of God as well as of lesser figures like Santa Claus to help tame the unruly. But mark what happens if the child should stray to another faith, let alone another cult, even in early adolescence. The parents will tend to proclaim that this is taking advantage of the innocent. All monotheisms have, or used to have, a very strong prohibition against apostasy for just this reason. In her memories of a Catholic girlhood, Mary McCarthy remembers her shock at learning from a Jesuit preacher that her Protestant grandfather, her guardian and friend, was doomed to eternal punishment because he had been baptized in the wrong way. A precociously intelligent child, she would not let the matter drop until she had made the Mother Superior consult some higher authorities and discover a loophole in the writings of Bishop Athanasius, who held that heretics were only damned if they rejected the true church with full awareness of what they were doing. Her grandfather, then, might be sufficiently unaware of the true church to evade hell. But what an agony to which to subject an 11-year-old girl. And only think of the number of less curious children who simply accepted this evil teaching without questioning it. Those who lie to the young in this way are wicked in the extreme. Two instances, one of immoral teaching and the other of immoral practice, may be adduced. The immoral teaching concerns abortion. As a materialist, I think it has been demonstrated that an embryo is a separate body and entity, and not merely, as some really did used to argue, a growth on or in the female body. There used to be feminists who would say that it was more like an appendix or even, this was seriously maintained, a tumour. That nonsense seems to have stopped. Of the considerations that have stopped it, one is the fascinating and moving view provided by the sonogram, and another is the survival of premature babies of feather-like weight who have achieved viability outside the womb. This is yet another way in which science can make common cause with humanism. Just as no human being of average moral capacity could be indifferent to the sight of a woman being kicked in the stomach, so nobody could fail to be far more outraged if the woman in question was pregnant. Embryology confirms morality. The words unborn child, even when used in a politicized manner, describe a material reality. However, this only opens the argument rather than closes it. There may be many circumstances in which it is not desirable to carry a fetus to full term. Either nature or God appears to appreciate this, since a very large number of pregnancies are aborted, so to speak, because of malformations, and are politely known as miscarriages. Sad though this is, it is probably less miserable an outcome than the vast number of deformed or idiot children who would otherwise have been born or stillborn, or whose brief lives would have been a torment to themselves and others. As with evolution in general, therefore, in utero we see a microcosm of nature and evolution itself. In the first place, we begin as tiny forms that are amphibian, before gradually developing lungs and brains, and growing and shedding that now useless coat of fur, and then struggling out and breathing fresh air after a somewhat difficult transition. Likewise, the system is fairly pitiless in eliminating those who never had a very good chance of surviving in the first place. Our ancestors on the savannah were not going to survive in their turn if they had a clutch of sickly and lolling infants to protect against predators. Here, the analogy of evolution might not be to Adam Smith's invisible hand, a term that I have always distrusted, so much as to Joseph Schumpeter's model of creative destruction, whereby we accustom ourselves to a certain amount of natural failure, taking into account the pitilessness of nature and extending back to the remote prototypes of our species. Thus, not all conceptions are, or ever were, going to lead to births. And ever since the mere struggle for existence began to abate, it has been an ambition of the human intelligence to gain control over the rate of reproduction. Families who are at the mercy of mere nature, with its inevitable demand for profusion, will be tied to a cycle that is not much better than animal. The best way of achieving a measure of control is by prophylaxis, which has been restlessly sought since records were kept, and which has in our own time become relatively foolproof and painless. The second best fallback solution, which sometimes may be desirable for other reasons, is termination of pregnancy, an expedient which is regretted by many even when it's been undertaken in dire need. All thinking people recognize a painful conflict of rights and interests in this question, and strive to achieve a balance. The only proposition that is completely useless, either morally or practically, is the wild statement that sperms and eggs are all potential lives, which must not be prevented from fusing, and that, when united however briefly, have souls and must be protected by law. On this basis, an intrauterine device that prevents the attachment of the egg to the wall of the uterus is a murder weapon, and an ectopic pregnancy, the disastrous accident that causes the egg to begin growing inside the fallopian tube, is a human life, instead of an already doomed egg that is also an urgent threat to the life of the mother. Every single step toward the clarification of this argument has been opposed root and branch by the clergy. The attempt even to educate people in the possibility of family planning was anathematized from the first, and its early advocates and teachers were arrested, like John Stuart Mill, or put in jail or thrown out of their jobs. Only a few years ago, Mother Teresa denounced contraception as the moral equivalent of abortion, which logically meant, since she regarded abortion as murder, that a sheath or a pill was a murder weapon also. She was a little more fanatical even than her church, but here again we can see that the strenuous and the dogmatic is the moral enemy of the good. It demands that we believe the impossible and practice the unfeasible, by those who use unborn children as well as born ones as mere manipulable objects of their doctrine. As to immoral practice, it is hard to imagine anything more grotesque than the mutilation of infant genitalia, nor is it easy to imagine anything more incompatible with the argument from design. We must assume that a designer god would pay special attention to the reproductive organs of his creatures, which are so essential for the continuation of the species. But religious ritual, since the dawn of time, has insisted on snatching children from the cradle and taking sharp stones or knives to their pudenda. In some animist and Muslim societies, it is the female babies who suffer the worst, with the excision of the labia and the clitoris. This practice is sometimes postponed to adolescence and, as earlier described, accompanied by infibulation or the sewing up of the vagina, with only a small aperture for the passage of blood and urine. The aim is clear, to kill or dull the girl's sexual instinct and destroy the temptation to experiment with any man, save the one to whom she will be given, and who will have the privilege of rending those threads on the dreaded nuptial night. Meanwhile, she will be taught that her monthly visitation of blood is a curse. All religions have expressed a horror of it, and many still prohibit menstruating women from attending service, and that she is an unclean vessel. In other cultures, notably the Judeo-Christian, it is the sexual mutilation of small boys that is insisted upon. For some reason, little girls can be Jewish without genital alteration. It is useless to look for consistency in the covenants that people believe they have made with God. Here, the original motives appear to be twofold. The shedding of blood, which is insisted upon at circumcision ceremonies, is most probably a symbolic survival from the animal and human sacrifices, which were such a feature of the gore-soaked landscape of the Old Testament. By adhering to the practice, parents could offer to sacrifice a part of the child as a stand-in for the whole. Objections to interference with something that God must have designed with care, the human penis, were overcome by the invented dogma that Adam was born circumcised and in the image of God. Indeed, it is argued by some rabbis that Moses, too, was born circumcised, though this claim may result from the fact that his own circumcision is nowhere mentioned in the Pentateuch. The second purpose, very unambivalently stated by Maimonides, was the same as for girls, the destruction as far as possible of the pleasurable side of sexual intercourse. Here is what the sage tells us in his Guide to the Perplexed. With regard to circumcision, one of the reasons for it is, in my opinion, the wish to bring about a decrease in sexual intercourse and a weakening of the organ in question, so that this activity be diminished and the organ be in as quiet a state as possible. It has been thought that circumcision perfects what is defective congenitally. How can natural things be defective, so that they need to be perfected from outside? All the more because we know how useful the foreskin is for that member. In fact, this commandment has not been prescribed with a view to perfecting what is defective congenitally, but to perfecting what is defective morally. The bodily pain caused to that member is the real purpose of circumcision. The fact that circumcision weakens the faculty of sexual excitement and sometimes perhaps diminishes the pleasure is indubitable. For if at birth this member has been made to bleed and has had its covering taken away from it, it must indubitably be weakened. Maimonides did not seem particularly impressed by the promise made to Abraham in Genesis 17 that circumcision would lead to his having a vast progeny at the age of 99. Abraham's decision to circumcise his slaves as well as his male household was a side issue, or perhaps an effect of enthusiasm, since these non-Jews were not part of the covenant. But he did circumcise his son Ishmael, who was then 13. Ishmael only had to part with his foreskin. His younger brother Isaac, oddly described as Abraham's only son in Genesis 22, was circumcised when he was 8 days old, but later offered as a sacrifice in his whole person. Maimonides also argued that circumcision would be a means of reinforcing ethnic solidarity, and he laid particular stress on the need to perform the operation on babies, rather than on those who had reached the age of reason. The first argument is that if the child were let alone until he grew up, he would sometimes not perform it. The second is that a child does not suffer as much pain as a grown-up man, because his membrane is still soft and his imagination weak, for a grown-up man would regard the thing, which he would imagine before it occurred, as terrible and hard. The third is that the parents of a child that is just born take lightly matters concerning it, for up to that time the imaginative form that compels the parents to love it is not yet consolidated. Consequently, if it were left uncircumcised for 2 or 3 years, this would necessitate the abandonment of circumcision because of the father's love and affection for it. At the time of its birth, on the other hand, this imaginative form is very weak, especially as far as concerns the father upon whom this commandment is imposed. In ordinary words, Maimonides is perfectly aware that, if not supposedly mandated by God, this hideous procedure would, even in the most devout parent, he stipulates only a father, create a natural revulsion in favor of the child. But he represses this insight in favor of divine law. In more recent times, some pseudo-secular arguments have been adduced for male circumcision. It has been argued that the process is more hygienic for the male and thus more healthy for females, in helping them avoid, for example, cervical cancer. Medicine has exploded these claims, or else revealed them as problems which can just as easily be solved by a loosening of the foreskin. Full excision, originally ordered by God as the blood price for the promised future massacre of the Canaanites, is now exposed for what it is, a mutilation of a powerless infant with the aim of ruining its future sex life. The connection between religious barbarism and sexual repression could not be plainer than when it is marked in the flesh. Who can count the number of lives that have been made miserable in this way, especially since Christian doctors began to adopt ancient Jewish folklore in their hospitals? And who can bear to read the medical textbooks and histories which calmly record the number of boy babies who died from infection after their 8th day, or who suffered gross and unbearable dysfunction and disfigurement? The record of syphilitic and other infection from rotting rabbinical teeth or other rabbinical indiscretions, or of clumsy slitting of the urethra and sometimes a vein, is simply dreadful. And it is permitted in New York in 2006. If religion and its arrogance were not involved, no healthy society would permit this primitive amputation or allow any surgery to be practiced on the genitalia without the full and informed consent of the person concerned. Religion is also to be blamed for the hideous consequences of the masturbation taboo, which also furnished yet another excuse for circumcision among the Victorians. For decades, millions of young men and boys were terrified in adolescence by supposedly medical advice that warned them of blindness, nervous collapse, and descent into insanity if they resorted to self-gratification. Stern lectures from clergymen, replete with nonsense about semen as an irreplaceable and finite energy source, dominated the upbringing of generations. Robert Baden-Powell composed an entire obsessive treatise on the subject, which he used to reinforce the muscular Christianity of his Boy Scout movement. To this day, the madness persists on Islamic websites purporting to offer counsel to the young. Indeed, it seems that the mullahs have been poring over the same discredited texts by Samuel Tissot and others, which used to be wielded by their Christian predecessors to such dire effect. The identical weird and dirty-minded misinformation is on offer, especially from Abdulaziz bin Baz, the late Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, whose warnings against onanism are repeated on many Muslim sites. The habit will disrupt the digestive system, he warns, damage the eyesight, inflame the testicles, erode the spinal cord, the place from which sperm originates, and lead to tremors and shakes. Nor are the cerebral glands unaffected, with concomitant decline in IQ and eventual insanity. Last of all, and still tormenting millions of healthy youngsters with guilt and worry, the Mufti tells them that their semen will grow thin and insipid and prevent them from becoming fathers later on. The Inter-Islam and Islamic Voice sites recycle this tripe, as if there were not already enough repression and ignorance among young males in the Muslim world, who are often kept apart from all female company, taught in effect to despise their mothers and sisters, and subjected to stultifying rote recitation of the Quran. Having met some of the products of this education system in Afghanistan and elsewhere, I can only reiterate that their problem is not so much that they desire virgins as that they are virgins. Their emotional and psychic growth irremediably stunted in the name of God, and the safety of many others menaced as a consequence of this alienation and deformation. Sexual innocence, which can be charming in the young if it is not needlessly protracted, is positively corrosive and repulsive in the mature adult. Again, how shall we reckon the harm done by dirty old men and hysterical spinsters, appointed as clerical guardians to supervise the innocent in orphanages and schools? The Roman Catholic Church in particular is having to answer this question in the most painful of ways, by calculating the monetary value of child abuse in terms of compensation. Billions of dollars have already been awarded, but there is no price to be put on the generations of boys and girls who were introduced to sex, in the most alarming and disgusting ways, by those whom they and their parents trusted. Child abuse is really a silly and pathetic euphemism for what's been going on. We're talking about the systematic rape and torture of children, positively aided and abetted by a hierarchy which knowingly moved the grossest offenders to parishes where they would be safer. Given what has come to light in modern cities in recent times, one can only shudder to think what was happening in the centuries where the church was above all criticism. But what did people expect would happen when the vulnerable were controlled by those who, misfits and inverts themselves, were required to affirm hypocritical celibacy, and who were taught to state grimly, as an article of belief, that children were imps of, or limbs of, Satan? Sometimes the resulting frustration expressed itself in horrible excesses of corporal punishment, which is bad enough in itself. But when the artificial inhibitions really collapse, as we have seen them do, they result in behavior which no average masturbating, fornicating sinner could even begin to contemplate without horror. This is not the result of a few delinquents among the shepherds, but an outcome of an ideology which sought to establish clerical control, by means of control of the sexual instinct and even of the sexual organs. It belongs, like the rest of religion, to the fearful childhood of our species. Alyosha's answer to Ivan's question about the sacred torture of a child was to say, softly, "No, I do not agree." Our reply, to the repellent original offer of the defenceless boy Isaac on the pyre, right up to the current abuses and repressions, must be the same, only not delivered so softly.